First, I want to thank Anlar for her really brilliant talk last night. It was almost worth all the suffering that she had to go through in order to give it. I actually woke up this morning with a pain in my neck just listening to her describe so vividly the pain that I remembered very well, how she suffered with that pain in her neck year after year. But no, if I had a wish, I would wish that she had not given that Dharma talk and that she had not gone through all that she had to go through in order to give it. But it is great, isn't it? Really great. That after all that she has experienced, she's okay. Isn't that something? And that she can express herself with such elegance and humanity, that's really amazing and encouraging for all of us who practice the Dharma. So thank you, Anlar, for that. And another session morning. The 9,172nd session morning of our lifetime, or so. I hope everybody is surviving okay. How are we doing? It's a funny question, you know. How are you doing? And you're supposed to answer that. The more you look, you know, the harder it is to answer a question like that, because the mind is always moving. Even if you're very still, there's some movement. We have so many thoughts and experiences, one after the other, you know. And then we have this general frame of mind that we call something like a mood. Happy, sad, joyful, despairing. We have a kind of general mood within which the various thoughts and feelings come and go. Sometimes they agree with the mood, sometimes they don't, but there's a general condition that changes. Maybe it has to do with the weather or the stars above. And you observe how your mood changes according to conditions, things that happen or things that have happened. And it's very much on purpose that in Sesshin we organize the conditions so that they're really, really simple and peaceful. And since in Sesshin we are not immersed in the daily news and all the things that all the people are saying about the daily news. No thanks. I turn the volume off, I do everything that I can think of, but my device is in charge and knows that it's time to ring a little bell right now. Thank you very much. It's unbelievable, you know. Somebody is trying to sell me something all day and all night long. They never get tired of it. Even though I don't buy any of it, they never still don't get tired. What was I saying? Something. Something about our mood and the conditions, right, conditions. Condition our mood. You notice this, right? That's why we make very smooth conditions. So that the only thing that there is to disturb us is our own minds. And that's enough, right? We don't need any extra things. And that's good, because that's what we want. We want to be disturbed only by our own minds. We don't want to be stirred up any more than we're already stirred up. And we notice, and we learned this yesterday from our teacher, Sojin Roshi, we learned that, oh, it turns out that the conditions of our mind are also in our body. So when we breathe and when we take care of our posture, we're also taking care of our mind. Sesshin is a time to purify our hearts and let our ancient twisted karma ripen and little by little fall away. As we chant every morning, I now fully avow, which means I allow it, I admit it, and I let it go. Somewhere in Zen mind, beginner's mind, Suzuki Roshi says that sitting in Zazen is like baking bread in the oven. We just apply a little bit of heat, gentle heat, and the bread won't rise because that's what bread does. Flour and water and yeast and other ingredients will eventually become bread. And that's how Zazen changes our lives, even though we're not necessarily trying to change our lives. I was recently writing an essay on Shila, a moral conduct for the Buddhist magazine. They asked me to write that essay, and for some reason I had to write it a number of times. And I was trying to explain in that essay how Zazen practice and the practice of ethical conduct go hand in hand. And I wrote in there something like this. It is very common, especially in sesshins, to experience great remorse for things said or done, or sometimes great grief or dismay at things that have been said or done to us, the things that have happened to us, that at the time, maybe they seemed normal and justifiable and innocent, or maybe even at the time they seemed pretty devastating. And then you sit there and you experience whatever it is, grief, anger, remorse, shame, some really strong emotion that comes out of nowhere. And we know how to keep breathing anyway. Keep coming back to the body, and little by little the emotion settles. We don't push it away. We don't deny it. And when you have that experience, it changes your feeling. And when your feeling settles, your mind becomes more settled in Zazen, you can concentrate better. And that brings up even worse things older and more embedded in you that you never would have noticed otherwise. And then you practice with that. And the same thing happens over and over and over again. There is seemingly no end to this process, which thankfully becomes smoother and less painful as it goes on. Maybe some of you know what I'm talking about and have been experiencing this. And again, the key point is never to lose track of your Zazen. Never to lose track of your breathing and your body and your vow to stay in your seat and to return to your seat and do your best. Not to run away. And when you do that, you can be confident that whatever needs to happen in you is going to happen, whether you realize it or not. I will now take a break from my Dharma talk right now. And I will read you a little poem, part of a recent poem of mine, a long poem, maybe it's 25 or 30 pages long, that I wrote with a lot of delight in a tiny little handmade notebook that Shufi gave me. And this poem starts on the first page of the notebook and it ends on the last page. And it has short little lines because the notebook is very small. Like all my poems, it is written without a plan or an idea or a particular point of view. And like all my poems, the subject matter of the poem is the words in the poem, especially the nice little ones. I like the little words. I said the poem ends, but actually it doesn't end, this poem. It spills over into the next unwritten poem. You remember a few months ago, I told you that I lost a dear friend, Lynn Hajinian. She was a very important friend to me of many, many years. She wrote a famous essay, often cited, called Against Closure, in which she said that to end a poem is an artificial and fake gesture, that real poems could never end. Also, I think they never begin. They've already always begun. So I always religiously follow Lynn's rule of no closure. And I'm saying all this so that you don't expect that there's going to be any payoff to this poem, that it's going to lead you somewhere that will be edifying or in any way uplifting or increase your knowledge in any way. It simply goes on forever. Anyway, I'm not going to read you the whole thing, obviously, but I'll just read you a little snippet that I randomly got from it. A summer daisy spent, a spring daffodil pent into bud, soon to be released into midday's heat. That's the season. In itself, each and every single one in being what it is, while it is. When I stand before I fall, let me please release my relief at the open hand of space to ply me forth into myself a wish, a hearth, a place to stand. Heart.org. In straight lines that run left to right, right to left till it stop. Oh my heart, do please beat with regularity. Don't plug or stop yet. For a while, move above and below the lines. Attention is a deficit of disorder. A mind that flits from thought to thought across time's small gaps in worlds that unfold themselves as formed by melted air. Oh, fog today obscures the sky in creamy, cloudless clouds in layers, one on one another above curvaceous hills, perched auspicious above the sea. Thought runs on in sculpted words on little pages in tiny, disappearing, curling worlds where I pops out to look for something to have and to hold. Can you hear the music once again that played then in places where you were when you seemed to exist as persons do, mixed with the scenic quantity and weight of that endless time when you almost disappeared into the tiny gap that holds you now in place, oh my soul. And the final little bit, these are all little bits, you know, the final little bit. Yes, my friend, we all grow old, our chins fold and crumple under our saggy mouths we are long in tooth, short of breath, and hazy on the details. But our grip on life is firm, for the alternative, though evocative, does not compute. And the face in the glass was a lie at last the whole time. For this, having arrived, must seem to depart. This unknowable this, this peculiar twist. I thought we needed a little break from all these ponderous Dharma talks. I needed a break from all these ponderous Dharma talks. So now, continuing with the ponderous Dharma talk, I have words from our grandfather, teacher, Suzuki Roshi. In this passage, he's talking about lots of things, but especially he's talking about expression or communication. So these are his words. The purpose of my talk is not to give you some intellectual understanding, but just to express my appreciation for our Zen practice. To be able to sit with you in Zazen is very, very unusual. Of course, whatever we do is unusual, because our life itself is so unusual. Incredible, right? It's so true. But, I mean, if you had the worst problem in the world and you said, wow, you know, my life is so unusual, I'm lucky to be alive, it's amazing, the problem would be different. But no, we forget how unusual it is, this life. Anyway, Buddha said, back to Suzuki Roshi, Buddha said, to appreciate your human life is as rare as soil on your fingernail. You know, dirt hardly ever sticks on your fingernail. Our human life is rare and wonderful. When I sit, I want to remain sitting forever. But I encourage myself to have another practice, for instance, to recite the sutra or to bow. And when I bow, I think, this is wonderful. But I have to change my practice again to recite the sutra. So, the purpose of my talk is to express my appreciation. That is all. Our way is not to sit to acquire something, it is to express our true nature. That is our practice. If you want to express yourself, your true nature, there should be some natural and appropriate way of expression, even swaying right and left as you sit down or get up from Zazen is an expression of yourself. It is not preparation for practice or relaxation after practice. It is part of the practice. So we should not do it as if we were preparing for something else. And this should be true in your everyday life. To cook or fix some food is not preparation, according to Dogen. It is practice. To cook is not just to prepare food for someone or for yourself. It is to express your sincerity. So when you cook, you should express yourself in your activity in the kitchen. You should allow yourself plenty of time. You should work on it with nothing in your mind and without expecting anything. Just cook. That's also an expression of our sincerity, a part of our practice. And this is the way we want to sit in Zazen. But sitting is not our only way. Whatever you do, it should be an expression of the same deep activity. We should appreciate what we are doing. There is no preparation for something else. The Bodhisattva's way is called the single-minded way, or one railway track thousands of miles long. The railway track, that's hard to say. The railway track is always the same. If it were to become wider or narrower, it would be disastrous. Wherever you go, the railway track is always the same. That's the Bodhisattva's way. So, even if the sun were to rise from the west, the Bodhisattva only has one way. Their way is in each moment to express their nature, their sincerity. We say railway track, but actually there's no such thing. Sincerity itself is the railway track. And the sights we see from the train will change, but we're always running on the same track. And there is no beginning, no end to the track. It's a beginningless and endless track. No starting point, no goal, nothing to attain. Just run on the track is our way. That's the nature of our Zen practice. When you become curious about the railway track, danger is there. You should not see the railway track. If you look at the track, you will become dizzy. Just appreciate the sights you see from the train. This is our way. There is no need for the passengers to be curious about the track. Someone will take care of it. Buddha will take care of it. This is an example of something that Suzuki Roshi said that we scratch our heads and we think, what? I'm not sure I really agree with that anyway, Suzuki Roshi. Too bad, we can't ask him, you know. Anyway, he goes on. But sometimes we try to explain the railway track because we become curious. If something is always the same, we wonder, how is it possible for the Bodhisattva always to be the same? What is the Bodhisattva's secret? But there is no secret. Everyone has the same nature as the railway track. There were once two good friends, Chokei and Hofuku. They were talking about the Bodhisattva's way, and Chokei said, even if the arhat were to have evil desires, still the Buddha does not have two kinds of words. I say that the Buddha has words, but no dualistic words. Hofuku said, even though you say so, your comment is not perfect. Chokei asked, what is your understanding of the Tathagata's words? And Hofuku said, that's enough discussion. Let's have a cup of tea. Now Suzuki Roshi is commenting on that story he just told. Hofuku did not give his friend an answer because it is impossible to give a verbal interpretation of our way. Nevertheless, as part of their practice, these two good friends discussed the Bodhisattva's way, even though they did not expect to find a new interpretation. That's why Hofuku answered, our discussion is over, let's have a cup of tea. That's a very good answer, isn't it? It's the same for my Dharma talk. When my talk is over, your listening is over. There's no need to remember what I say. There's no need to understand what I say. You understand already. You have full understanding within yourself. There is no problem. That's a great passage. I've always loved that passage in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I think he's saying a lot of things in there that are very important. In Zen practice, and it's possible that Zen is unique in this particular idea, the Dharma itself and transmitting the Dharma, in other words, communicating, expressing, sharing the Dharma, and the Dharma are the same thing. There's no difference. It's not that there's the Dharma and then you share it. The sharing of the Dharma, the expression, the communication of the Dharma is the Dharma. There is no Dharma like sitting over there in the corner like a giant towering lump that we're gazing at from a distance. The Dharma is itself expression, communication. It's something that moves, that develops, that can never be caught and held. Nothing to have and to hold. And we think of communication as words or intentional expressions, maybe communicating through art or giving a speech. But as Suzuki Roshi is saying, and also as Dogen is saying in Radiant Light, expression is the world. The whole world is the expression, including you and me and our bodies and minds and words. The whole world is God talking, radiant light shining, a glorious appearance, full of meaning, but not meaning outside of things, meaning as things themselves. It is tremendously meaningful to be alive. And the world itself, and each and everything that happens in the world has tremendous meaning, even though there's no end to this meaning and we can never discover it. That's why Suzuki Roshi says we can't figure out the railroad tracks. And yet, his little story illustrates that we always have to try. That's how we are. And even though I really don't say anything much in my Dharma talks, I have to talk because that's our tradition. Zazen Kyenhin, Zazen Kyenhin, Dharma talk. What can you do? Somebody talks. So I'm talking. And in the last few days, some of you have come to tell me very sweetly, it's really touched me, that you listen to my Dharma talks online. Of course, I'm unaware of that. But when you tell me, then I know. And it's very moving that you listen, and I really appreciate it. There are so many Dharma talks on that website. How many Dharma talks have I given over all these, whatever it's been, years, 30, 40 more years? A lot of them, thousands of them, I think, I gave before there was even websites. I have someplace in a dusty corner archives of tapes, you know, audio tapes and CDs of Dharma talks molding away. It seems as if I have been talking forever. That I never began, and I will never stop. And this is true. I did not begin. Long before I started to talk, other voices were talking. And when my voice falls silent, other voices will continue to drone on and on without ever explaining the Dharma or coming to the end of the effort to explain. And yet the Dharma is so perfectly clear. Everything is expressing it all of the time. And then when I'm done talking, we can all safely get up and bow and then chant the service, and go have lunch, and let the beautiful food and our enjoyment of it express the Dharma. As everybody here knows, it's been an important feature of our everyday Zen practice to express the Dharma by speaking to one another. At the end of our seminar talk, we've never had what they call question and answer. We don't have question and answer, we have discussion. We talk together in our little breakout groups after the seminar talk. And during the practice period, we have partners so that we can talk to one another about practice. And that's so that we all have a chance to share our understanding in our own words, in our own way, in the context of our own lives, and to listen to one another. And in this way, we create Sangha, one of the three jewels, which is so necessary to our practice. And what we say isn't so important, but that we say it is very important. One of the things about human beings is they talk, so we should talk. But also, we're not just human beings. Also, we're all kinds of other beings. So it's very important that we don't need to talk. We should talk when it's time to talk. But also, we should know how to be silent, just like lots of the other animals. So in Sesshin, we listen to the talk and we don't say anything. Because in Sesshin, we're learning how to shut up and not talk. Just be receptive to the world around us. To appreciate the peacefulness of not having to do anything or fix anything or save anyone. There's going to be doing and fixing and saving enough later on. In Sesshin, we're trying to learn how to do and fix and save with silence in the middle of those activities so that we are okay with what we have to do. Not desperate, not distracting ourselves all the time, but always and only expressing the Dharma and expressing our humanity. There's a long discussion in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind titled Communication. It's many pages long, and Suzuki Roshi says in it, in my opinion, some rather dubious things, but nevertheless, he says some really important things in there too. Among them is this. To understand your master's words or your master's language is to understand your master himself. And when you understand him, you find his words are not just ordinary language, but language in its wider sense. Through your master's language, you understand more than what his words actually say. He then goes on to say that there's no way that anybody can ever say anything without distortion. So the words are always distorted, but nevertheless, through the words, we can understand something that is true without distortion. And then he says the words of the master aren't just words. The way the master behaves is part of his expression. And this is now a direct quote. In Zen, we put emphasis on demeanor or behavior. By behavior, we don't mean a particular way you ought to behave, but rather the natural expression of yourself. We emphasize straightforwardness. You should be true to your feelings and your mind, expressing yourself without reservations. I find this passage really interesting because Suzuki Roshi, I think, here is speaking very personally. He's talking about himself. When he says, your master, he's talking about himself. That's why he says he, because he means me, him. And maybe you notice he uses the word master. We never use that word, you know, Zen master. Maybe sometimes we use that word to refer to Suzuki Roshi or to the great masters of the West. Sorry, the great masters of old, but we never use the word to refer to teachers in the West, especially contemporary teachers. The word master in this context, I don't think, is the master of master and slave. It's the master of master and apprentice. And in the old days, and Suzuki Roshi was born in 1904, and he grew up practically in the 19th century, even though it was the 20th century, it was really old Japan. And that's how he trained. The template for Zen training was apprenticeship. Dharma students were like apprentices who learn not in classrooms, but by doing, by practicing side by side with their teachers and observing the teacher's demeanor and behavior, as well as listening to their words. And by observing the person closely over time, you could understand the words better. You knew what the person was talking about. Rather than, as we do now, inevitably project our own subjective preferences onto the words we hear. But in that system of apprenticeship, you could get a feeling for what the language meant, as he says, in a wider sense. I think I've said before that something I really admire about Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and also in Not Always So, is the sense of authority that you can hear in his words. He's not saying, well, it seems to me, or in my opinion, he's saying, this is how it is. Of course, he was a human being, and he changed his mind sometimes. He was probably wrong about things a lot of the times. And yet, when he spoke with full authority. I mean, this makes sense, since he was speaking as a person over 60 years old who had spent his entire life practicing Zen. His dad was a Zen priest. He grew up in a Zen temple. He grew up in a Zen culture. And he was addressing mostly young American Zen students who had no idea about Zen practice and whose opinions about it couldn't be other than fantastic. So he was always correcting their opinions. So it made sense, right, that he would speak with authority. These days, most of us in the talking seat around here are not as seasoned in the practice as Suzuki Roshi was, and we will never be as seasoned in the practice as Suzuki Roshi was, because we will never have grown up in the practice as thoroughly as he did. And we're not speaking to beginners, to young people. We're speaking to mature people, mature in life and also mature in practice, people who have practiced the Dharma for decades. So we're not masters. And we don't have apprentices. And yet, when we take the seat, we have to remember that it is not just us speaking. We are taking our small voice and adding it to the voices of the past, and we speak with their authority. In the Jewish tradition, there's a wonderful custom. If you ever read the Talmud, you know, it says there, Rabbi something like, I'm making this up, but it says something like, Rabbi Chiya said in the name of Rabbi Natan, and so on. In other words, this rabbi is speaking not in his own voice, but in the voice of someone else, in the authority of his predecessors. And it's the same for us. Each one of us has an absolutely unique voice. And it's our joy and our obligation to speak the Dharma with that voice that is uniquely ours. In the entire cosmos, no one has the voice that you have. No one has the expression of the Dharma that you have. And you have to find that voice. And when you do, you find that it is at the same time yours and unique and also identical to the voices of the past, the voices of all of your ancestors. These days, if you are paying even a little attention and your heart is open even a little bit to the world, you might well become a horrible misanthrope. How can human beings be so destructive, cruel, thoughtless, heartless? What a mess we are making of things. You might wonder, as I have been wondering a lot lately, can human beings ever figure out, are we capable of figuring out just how to live together? Can we figure out how to govern our societies in a way that's even a little bit fair and just? Could we even a little bit stop burning these terrible fuels that are killing us? Even like back off a little bit? Are we capable? You could really start becoming an anti-human. And that's why I'm saying that I think we really have to look more deeply. We really have to have faith in our ancestors. We have to have faith in our human past, however imperfect it may seem. We really have to have faith in those who have gone before and in those who will come after. When we sit in Zazen long enough for the dust to settle, I think that's what we find. We find that faith. Because we have faith in our own sitting, faith in our own Buddha nature, faith in our own true nature, faith in our own breath, in our own radiant light, we can have faith in human beings and in the human future, come what may. I think it's really important that we have that faith and that confidence, not only for ourselves, so that we can stay sane and happy, but for everyone else who needs that faith. So once again, I thank you all for your kind and generous listening. Please take care of yourself the rest of the day.